Senate Bill 3141. And that one. No, hold on, Paul. Yeah, Paul, you want to come on up too? Come on up, yeah. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, members, and Ms. Talbot, Legislative Coordinator for the Employment Department. Mr. Chair, is it your intention that I go first, or would you like the proponents of the measure to go first?
No, thank you, Chair. I guess. Paul, do you want to start then, I guess?
Thank you,
Madam. Are you Gary? This Gary?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Gary, go ahead and start.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name for the record is Paul Phillips of Southwest Communications, representing the Nike today. The measure before you, 3141, is here because it's an issue of fairness for all types of businesses and all sizes of business. The measure very simply would allow a company that goes through a change in ownership to maintain its current unemployment tax computation unless there is a substantial change in the manner the business was run. I would like to thank the Employment Department for the work that they put into this bill. Early on, we thought we were going to get some compliance issues with the federal government, but by making it proactive and prospective, we were able to deal with that. The bill, one, is, in that light, provides flexibility to the Employment Department to allow partial transfers on experience and payroll based on the rules that they just developed. And Annette certainly will walk you through that process. With that, Mr. Chair, I'll save the majority of my remarks until after my client speaks, which is always a delicate way and a good way to handle your clients. But with that, I will introduce for the record the support of Association of Oregon Industries documentation and my client's comments, and just sum up my remarks by saying not only have we had AOI, but the small business, the chambers, everybody from interior designers, when you run this situation through what happened, oh, I know somebody that it happened to, and it wasn't until Nike brought this to me that I realized that in my own business where I bought a small four-member firm that the exact same type of thing was susceptible to me. So all sizes of businesses are vulnerable, but I think when this bill passes, we'll address that. And with that, Gary?
Okay, please introduce yourself again, Gary.
Good afternoon, Chairman Nelson and members of the committee. My name is Gary Odegaard, and I'm the U.S. Region Tax Manager for Nike. The reason I'm appearing here today is to represent Nike in support of House Bill 3141. House Bill 3141 provides a solution to a problem that is currently negatively impacting Oregon businesses. It allows for employers who have a positive employment record to utilize its employment tax rate in the event of a partial transfer of its businesses. Essentially, House Bill 3141 is about fairness to Oregon employers. Under Oregon law currently, if a business transfers its entire employing enterprise to a new company, then that business receives the employment experience and tax rate of the original entity. However, partial transfers of businesses do not qualify for this favorable tax treatment. When there's a partial transfer, the law does not allow the newly created company to benefit from a good tax rate earned by the original employer. Instead, the new company is assigned a new base rate, which in many cases is significantly higher than the rate earned by a positive employment history. Businesses frequently modify their business structures for a variety of business reasons. In Nike's case, we established a new subsidiary and transferred a significant amount of employees and property to this new business. The employees themselves, it was basically transparent. Their business activities didn't change, their jobs didn't change, and the beneficial ownership of the assets did not change either because they remain components of Nike's consolidated group. Despite the fact that nothing really changed from a business operations perspective, the new company was deemed to be a new employer and assigned a new employer tax rate. In Nike's case, this resulted in approximately 150% increase in the employment tax expense. From Nike's perspective, 3141.6 is what Nike perceives to be three problems with the current law. It penalizes companies with positive employment history. It inhibits business flexibility because of the costs associated with the partial transfers, and ignores the experience ratings of companies that have been good employers within the state. More than 40 states have rules permitting partial transfers of experience from one predecessor employer to another. This legislation would ensure that businesses that have established a positive employment history within Oregon will not suffer an unjust financial burden for transfers of less than the entire business. As in other states, such legislation would improve the fairness of the existing statute and protect employment histories for those who have operated in a positive manner, you know, had positive employment history. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity to testify, and I thank the Employment Department for working towards a positive solution in drafting the bill and the amendment. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Why don't we go ahead and hire Annette Miller and do her testimony?
Mr. Chair, again, Annette Talbot, Legislative Coordinator for the Employment Department. I believe that the previous speakers have indicated what the bill does, but I wanted to contrast that a little bit with what current law is. And I think they say a picture's worth a thousand words, so we've developed a couple of really basic charts that are attached to my testimony that I will walk you through real briefly. I know you have a lot on your agenda. As the previous speakers have indicated, a company right now that breaks off and starts a new company, even though it has an existing experience rating, it's not able to take advantage of that under current law. We do allow total transfers of experience, but not partial transfers.
Annette, can I get an interview from Max? Do you want to testify on this bill? Are you? Is it what? Let's get Max back to the committee. Can we just interrupt you for a second? We'll have to close hearing on that, and then we'll open up a public hearing. Can you think of this, the thing that you're doing here? You just create all this aura about you. Which one is it we're doing here now?
2978.
Open up public hearing on Senator House Bill 2978. Changes in unemployment insurance tax. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Max Williams, State Representative, House District 9, and I certainly apologize for having to interrupt your previous bill to hear this, but I appreciate the committee's indulgence, and this will allow me to get back to my judiciary committee. House Bill 2978 is really a very small bill. It's quite frankly dependent on the federal government taking some action. Currently in Oregon, if a person employs a domestic employee, household employee, they are required to report quarterly on unemployment insurance taxes. Whereas, and it used to be the same for the federal system, but the federal government made a change, and now you're allowed to essentially report those taxes annually. It's a small change for a group of people who have these employees, but you've heard of a number of different people, quite famous actually, who've gotten in trouble for failure to pay the appropriate nanny taxes. Well, this is essentially that kind of a tax. But what the federal government did to their own system, they're not currently allowing states to do. So states still require, states still must collect this tax and have it be reported on a quarterly basis. What this bill does is essentially it allows and authorizes language within the statute that when the federal government does in fact either by rule or by law allow states to report on an annual basis, Oregon will have already enacted legislation which will allow the department to immediately enact an annual reporting system. I work with Ms. Talbot in the department on the House side to make sure the bill had proper amendments. I don't know whether they'd say they're supporting or opposing. I think at least they're neutral on the bill. It's just a small problem, and frankly, there has been several efforts at the federal level to change this so it doesn't go to an annual system. What happens is you report federally annually, but oftentimes taxpayers will miss their quarterly reporting and then get some substantial penalties associated with it. It's a small tax. These aren't typical employers in the sense that you consider an employer in a business situation. So it's a very small bill. that doesn't mean much, but hopefully the federal government will take that step and actually ease some reporting burden on Oregon taxpayers when the time comes. I'd be happy to answer any questions from the committee if you have any.
Any questions? Thank you, Matt.
Great. Thank you very much.
Back to committee. I know you want to get back to it. Really
sorry. Thank you very much.
Okay. And if you're going back to the other one, we will close the public hearing on 2978 and reopen the public hearing on 3141. And thank you for indulging in all that.
No problem, Mr. Chair. We were also going to testify on 2978, but Mr. Representative Williams did a great job of explaining it, so we'll just put our testimony in for the record on that.
Okay.
As we currently have 97,000 employers in the unemployment insurance system in this state. So about 1,200 new employers every month become entered into our system, and about 500 of these are what we call successor employers that would potentially be able to qualify under this bill. After we researched other states' laws, we estimate that about 100 of those 500 would qualify on this bill. So that's about 1,200 employers who might be able to take advantage of this bill, the proposal in House Bill 3141. If you take a look at the chart on Chart 1, which is attached to your testimony, I believe that I can just briefly give you a pretty good illustration of the differences that would be allowed under this bill. Under current laws, the previous speakers have indicated, when companies such as ABC Company would split, the new company, DEF, would not be able to take advantage of any prior experience and would be assigned what we call a base employer rate, which is 3% currently. And until they obtained experience, which takes anywhere from 2 to 2.5 years, they would be subject to that new employer rate. What House Bill 3141 would allow is the successor company, DEF, to take some percentage of its prior experience based on the percentage that it was of the original company and keep that tax rate. For a little while, a couple quarters, those two companies would actually be sharing experience because the new company needs to develop some, and we also need to have some payroll in the past to use as a basis for experience. So the bill would require that these two companies actually agree on this kind of shared experience, which we believe is only fair given that they could be adversely impacted depending on the new experience of the new company, and the old company. Part 2 shows a slightly different example where the current law would be where a predecessor actually dissolves into three new companies and they would all get a new experience rate. Under House Bill 3141, all of the various successors would be able to get and obtain their particular experience rating, at least until they establish the new rate on their own. The Part 3 gives an example of what happens with, and it's very technical, so if you'll indulge us for a little bit, your experience rating, as I said, is based on the maximum of 12 calendar quarters. So you're looking backwards for up to 3 years. So in these various examples, you can see how one transfer might affect the various companies. In the first example in Chart 3, they were both able to obtain after the transfer and retain the 2.4% rate that they had before. And the charges and the payroll are just apportioned based on the 75-25% split. And that doesn't cause a lot of trouble, and they both are able to obtain that new rate. What you see in Chart 4, however, is that how they could be impacted by the experience in the couple quarters right after they split. In Chart 4 shows that the ABC company retained its rate of 2.4, but actually DEF got a better rate because their payroll went up and their charges stayed the same. So again, the two companies are tied for a couple quarters in order to keep that experience rating. Chart 5 shows an example where the ABC company actually has their rate go up a little bit because they may have experienced some dislocation as a result of the difference in the change in the company structure. Just to point out to the committee that there are, you know, possibilities that go both ways for each company in terms of over time whether or not their rate would stay the same or increase or decrease, and that they are tied together. We do appreciate working with the sponsors of the bill so that we could get some of the changes that were necessary to the bill to get it implemented. We will end up having to do some manual computations of these new rates based on the fact that of the implementation date, even though mostly because of the availability of information services or information technology staff and our other Y2K work, it will take us a while to get this implemented. And we do have a fiscal impact that I've talked to the staff about, Mr. Chair, and we would very much appreciate the committees would send this bill to Ways and Means for purposes of considering, along with other bills that have passed this session that aren't budgeted, how we can rearrange our priorities or whether the Ways and Means would like us to come back to the emergency board. We will not get any new funds for this bill, so we will have to try to work with our other priorities that we have in some other bills that are in the hopper that also impact our budget, particularly because this will require us to hire some information services staff. So I believe the fiscal is attached to my testimony at the very end. As the previous speakers have indicated, this is a good policy that many other states have adopted, and the department certainly understands that it's the legislature's choice to adopt this policy. We would just like the budgetary impact to be reviewed at some point.
Are they put in the House? Was this issue brought up in the House?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
What was the discussion there?
Mr. Chair, I believe that the chair of that committee understood that because this was just federal funds, perhaps that it would need to go to Ways and Means. We don't understand that to be the policy on the Senate side, because we still have to live within our federal dollars at some way, and we won't get additional federal dollars for this. So even if it gets to Ways and Means for purposes of discussion and they tell us to come back to emergency board, at least we would have that direction and they would understand the different priorities that we're facing. At that time, also, we didn't have another bill that was in the hopper that has about $700,000 impact that's unbudgeted either. So we now face two different unbudgeted impacts that we would hope that the Ways and Means Committee could at least review and help us make priority.
I'm saying at this stage of the session, if we send it to Ways and Means, it might be lost. Which is more important, the policy or the money that this allocation?
Looking on the spot, Mr. Chair. I guess I need to speak with the director. I think that at some point we need to have the budget discussion. The end of our testimony certainly reflects that if this committee doesn't see fit to send it to Ways and Means, that at least we would hope that somewhere in the fiscal or on the record it's reflected that the emergency board would be able to take a look at this and help the department reprioritize. Because basically this change requires us to change almost 4 million lines of the 6 million line code in the unemployment insurance system. It's a huge change for the department and would impact us because we couldn't really undertake any other unemployment insurance changes that we would like to see happen in the next couple of years. So we would like to have that discussion at some point with the legislature so that that policy decision could be made.
Now, the cost here, are you restricted by federal law as to how you can use the money in the trust fund? How much do you need from the administration?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, we are given a specific grant based on a cost allocation model from the federal government. Unfortunately, that model was derived years and years ago, and they won't give us any more dollars even for increased workload. So we're stuck with the grant that we have.
You don't have access to the trust fund. You can only use what the grant is.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. The trust fund is for payment of benefits.
Paul,
you're losing tentative revenue, about $8 million from the trust fund.
Mr. Chair, as the previous speakers indicated, this goes back a couple tax years. So once we get this implemented, certain employers who had this type of successorship and split occur would be able to receive a credit against their future unemployment insurance taxes. So that would deplete the revenues that come into the unemployment trust fund for purposes of benefits.
Does any of that endanger the trust fund?
We take a dipstick once every year about the level of the trust fund, Senator Beyer, and some years it comes pretty close. If it's close, it could move us to a different schedule. It's hard to judge that now because as the economy changes, it's a model really based on the economy, so hard to predict that, but it certainly is a possibility. It's just I wouldn't want to predict it because I don't know what the economy is going to do in the next couple of years.
By my share. Thank you again for the record, Paul Phillips. In the House committee, I believe it was stated that this would not jeopardize the trust fund, and I don't believe if you look at even at the $8 million level, the size of the trust fund, that it would take a monumentous economic shift. I think that the word wasn't monumentous.
Mr. Chair, it is a $1 billion trust fund. What happens, not that the fund would be depleted, that we might move to a different tax schedule, and that's the only possibility that we're speaking to.
So, again, thank you. I just want to make it clear that we are nowhere suggesting in any stretch of the imagination that we would jeopardize that trust fund with this or any other proposal that we might come forward with. This is a non-general fund allocation, as Annette has explained, and I believe it should be a priority of the legislature, as it has been in the vast majority, 43-plus other states. And that's, if you look at the 1,200 businesses that will potentially benefit in their employment over a long period of time, makes a lot of sense.
Any further questions from the committee?
I have one question.
Yes, sure.
And maybe you can answer this one. Under the current system and under the proposed system, what happens if you have a merger of two companies with different experiences? How is that unemployment calculated, and does that change under this system at all?
Mr. Chair, if I may have our tax specialist, Jane Martin, speak to that, I think she'd be the best one to address that. Thank you.
Come up, please, Jane. Introduce yourself.
My name is Jane Martin, and I'm in the tax section of the Employment Department. Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, in answer to your question, a merger will not change under this bill. Currently, what happens is in the year of the merger, the two companies retain their tax rates. And then for the next experience trading year, we merge those experience and give it to the successor employee.
Put them in the old blender. And
correct.
Great.
Yeah. But this bill does not change how we handle those at all.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any other comments or the questions we've asked? The actions in the House and the federal funds?
No. In answer to Senator Beyer's concern about the general fund, the trust fund, and that answer was correct. It's not, and Mr. Phillips' response, it's not in jeopardy, but it could impact the schedule that we're in, which would impact our tax rate.
If you were to bump us up, what kind of rate increase are we looking at? Who would that apply to?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, it's hard to tell. It depends on how much the change is, but usually we only go from one schedule to the next. Currently, we're in Schedule 3. Going up to Schedule 4 would impact, it could impact each employer differently, but it would be like a percentage point for an employer, one-tenth of a percentage point for employers, but it depends on where they are in our array.
One-tenth of a percent increase, the maximum liability. I know you can't be precise, but just a sort of rule of thumb, if we were to bump up, you're talking about an increase in the rate by about 10%.
Correct. Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I do not recall exactly how much we would get in additional revenues for the whole state, but our rate is maxed at the 5.4 rate, so no one would get higher than a 5.4 rate.
And I guess I would feel free to correct me if I misstatement this at all, but again, for the record, I think it's important to note that under Mr. Beyer's scenario, if Senator, if they were to raise it even more, at least all taxpayers would be treated fairly based upon their schedule and their record. This is what we're trying to fix, to make sure that if you make changes, you actually get the schedule you've earned. And for employers, we encourage employers to earn positive employment records, and this is one way that would be certainly address that.
Further questions? Yes, we can help the outside. And I'll close the public hearing and open up the work session with comments from the committee members.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I think it's a reasonable proposal. The only question I have is one that I'm looking also to is on the fifth land tax and what that does to other things. Especially what they're telling us is that they can do this, but it will cost them about $1 million to make the transfer by anyone.
I think we were going to pass the bill with the idea that we have these budgetary notes here. At least a note or something that goes to the emergency department. The department wants a discussion on how that money is spent. I just feel if we sent ways and means at this stage of the game, we might not get this bill out.
That's kind of why.
If you feel that's a good, fairly good policy, that you feel it's fair, I don't know how the other committee members feel about that.
I don't have a big problem with
If you're comfortable with having the discussion with the chair of ways and means, I'm comfortable with that.
Okay. We can certainly do that. The chair would move House Bill 3141 to the floor to do pass recommendation. Any comments, questions, objections? So ordered. I will make a note that we do contact the sub-chair of the Lincoln Mall and make sure that we see what's going on here. Okay, we were on. What was that number just triggered? Amanda, are you still around?
No, we're going out to the bank.
Okay. Sorry, just give me. The unemployment. Okay. We'll come back to you in a second. We just got backed out of there quick, I guess. Okay, we're back at opening up a public hearing on 2122. And Chuck Craig and George. Chuck. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Chuck Craig with the Department of Agriculture. With me is George Shefchek, the administrator of our Measurement Standards Division. HB 2122 is a very straightforward fee reduction bill that pertains to what we call remote readouts in the jargon of our measurement standards, where most of you are familiar with the display inside the convenience store at the gas station that displays the amount of gasoline and the total cost of what you've purchased on the pump that you're at. The current law assesses a surcharge on the basic device fee, which in the case of the gas station would be the gas pump, of 50% for the remote readout, so that person that has a gas pump and remote readout is going to pay $37.50 instead of $25. When this fee was originally created, it was believed that checking devices with remote readouts would take more work and would cost more. We found that not to be true over the long run, so we're proposing a reduction in fees by eliminating this surcharge. It would amount to savings to Oregon businesses of about $157,000 a year, and of that, a large share of it would be the gas stations.
Thank you. You want to testify? You're here for expert witness.
Mr. Chairman, my name is George Shefchek, for the record. This bill, as Chuck said, was initiated a number of years ago to cover extra costs of testing these devices. The new technology now has come in that we can do that with the existing license fees for the device.
Very good. Any comments or questions, sir?
Yes, I just want to say, Mr. Chair, this is the first bill that we've had, and I'm kind of speaking for my colleague Lincoln here, to actually reduce fees, and I applaud the department for doing that, and good bill.
All right. So, do you have any further comments? Close public hearing on 2122, open up a work session, and Committee. Chair would move 21-22 to follow the due pass recommendation. Any comments? Anybody going to fight over carrying this on the floor?
I think we should assign it, Mr. Chair.
That's a good
senator. A good senator from White House Eagle. I think he would be okay. Pleased.
If there are no objections to House Bill 21-22 being moved to the floor, so ordered. Senator Miller will carry.
All right. It's a little foreign.
You can't have trouble later, won't we? Open up a public hearing on House Bill 22. Let's see, Roger. Roger, which one are you going to testify on? 398. We'll open up a...
That's the big one.
Well, thank you. Since the representative buyer is here for 398. How about it? We'll open up a public hearing on House Bill 398. And we'll take your testimony, and we'll come back to it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Roger Byer, State Representative, District 28. Here to testify today on House Bill 3098, which is an omnibus medical tenant bill. This bill has evolved over time, as many of you bills, especially being this issue, have. For those of you who have been here before know, this is the Landlord and Tenant Associations. Which have normally always been competing associations and very contentious issues at best. They have worked together on this issue for the past 2 years, and I think they started that process about three sessions ago, where they started in the interim going over the landlord-tenant laws and working to see where they can come to compromise and work out their differences before they bring a bill forward. They have done that in this case and have brought House Bill 3098 forward. I sponsored the bill at their request. So that's one part of the bill, is this on the landlord-tenant issue, dealing with primarily apartments and landlords. Also in this bill are a couple other issues, no less of importance of that issue. The bill ends up by repealing the Defense Project Housing Act, which is Section 38 of the bill on page 50. These laws were passed in the, I believe it was either the 39 or 41 legislative assembly, one or the other, which authorized defense project housing for the war effort. There were two projects used in the state. One was in the Roseburg area to build a home for loggers because there was a great need for wood products during the war effort. The other project was Vanport in the Portland area. These projects have come and have gone, as we all know, but the statutes have remained on the books for the past 50 years. We felt it was appropriate at the close of the century to maybe close the final chapter on the book of those on the House side. Representative Winters, who grew up in Vanport, read a very nice eulogy dealing with Vanport, and I would suggest maybe that Senator Adams, should this bill come to the floor, because he also lived in Vanport, may wish to speak to that, to the Vanport issue, because that, for the people who lived there, obviously it was a very hard time, but a very special time in the lives of the children, especially who lived there, a very nice community. It was the second largest city in the state at that time, even though it was never officially a city. And I believe, I don't know if you have received it yet. If you have not, I can someplace in my bill file, which is enormous on this bill. I have the testimony read by Representative Winters on the floor, and I'd be happy to make that available for the committee if you would also have that. I do have it with me, and I can make copies available for you.
Appreciate that, yeah. Mm-hmm. Senator Adams, she's not admitting he's that old. I talked to her about
that. Well, I have her admit that he grew up in Vanport. It's not completely kept in the dark. The third and final part of this bill is actually sections 1 through 4 of the printed bill. And this deals with the issue of forced removal of manufactured homes and manufactured home parks. This is another issue that the landlord, the park owners, and the tenant associations have been negotiating, as many of us know, on the issues of all the issues surrounding manufactured home parks. Once again, these are very contentious issues, and this is an agreement that was worked out amongst the park owners and the tenant associations. this issue deals with when a landlord can force a tenant to remove an older home out of a park. I understand there are some technical amendments to the whole bill relating to this issue and with the rest of the issues, specifically technical in nature, just because, as you know, you're very well aware, this committee passed Senate Bill 1088. I believe it's passed before already also. Maybe.
Not yet. We're scheduled it today. We'll see the barning.
Okay. Excuse me. I thought you got to it today. Anyways, the language in this bill and the language in that bill, this section of this bill and the language in that bill, we want to keep identical so that there are no conflicts between the two bills. And the technical amendments to this section of this bill will just conform the language to be identical to what is in 1088, assuming that bill will pass the Senate floor. So that is the issue. There will be some testimony in opposition to the bill today. There are some park owners here, I understand, who are not real happy with this section of that of this bill, or these sections of this bill. I would hope that you would listen to their testimony and take into account, but yet I am hoping that you move the bill forward. This is an important bill. This bill is greatly needed by both landlords and tenants, because we have to keep those groups at all issues at the bargaining table, at the talking point, so that it doesn't ever go beyond that. We won't get back into fighting like it was previously. They're talking now, and that's very helpful and very healthy. So I encourage you to move this bill forward and pass it out today, and we keep the process going. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? There is the Oregon Cable Telecommunications Association is going to suggest a very small amendment. I'd probably just need your response to it. They're going to want to delete the words cable television and insert the words video subscription service, because evidently in this day and age, cable television doesn't cover the entire spectrum of view. Would you have any problems with that amendment? We'll put that in there.
Mr. Chairman, I was just very recently, in the last 2 or 3 minutes, made aware of those amendments as I was standing in the hall, and I was told about that. And I do not have a problem with those amendments. It seems appropriate.
Thank you. Further questions?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. I will recess that hearing on 39-8. Come back to it eventually, I promise. Open the public hearing on House Bill 2243. Yes. Welcome again.
Mr. Chair, I thank you very much. Annette Talbot, Legislative Coordinator for the Employment Department. I figure this is Unemployment Insurance Day for your committee, so
that's what it is.
Hope you don't get tired of hearing from me. House Bill 2243, Mr. Chair, members, makes a fairly small change to the unemployment insurance law in regards to allowing employers to request relief of charges from their accounts. We currently have two different timelines in the law for requests for relief of charges. Last session, we changed most of the timelines to be 30 days so employers could ask for relief of charges. However, one was left at 10 days, and that's the request for relief of charges when an employee has been discharged for a theft or a felony. Employers have told us that these two different time frames have being confusing to them, so we introduced the bill to standardize the time frame to 30 days so that any request for relief would now be at 30 days. And it's a pretty small change, but I think it will be employer friendly, and so therefore they won't lose the time or lose the right to request relief as long as they know they're off for 30 days.
Okay. Thank you. I don't see anybody else signed up for that bill. Questions? Close the public hearing and open up a work session on House Bill 2243. The Senate Chair would move House Bill 2243 to close the due pass recommendation. Any comments? Objections? So ordered. Three, four, left. Senator Meyer would love to carry it, he said. You didn't really say it, did you? Well,
check.
For the record, we did assign Senator Miller.
Yes, Senator Messer.
Yeah, we're looking at you. Oops. Okay, we open up a public hearing on House Bill 2698. I think that's probably Annette again. We also have Brent Boyle. Weicher, is that right? supposed to come up. Why don't you both come up? We'll get everybody at the table at once. Hospital 2698.
Okay. Who wants to start here? Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. And for the record, my name is Robert Simmons. I represent the Association of Adult Foster Home Providers. As you all know, these are private homes that take up to five elderly Oregonians and provide care for them on a 24-hour basis. There are approximately 1,950 of those homes in the state. What House Bill 2698 does is relieve an employer's unemployment insurance reserve account of charges when the employer has terminated an employee on the express instruction of a government agency. I just remembered I should have given the staff lady these. You hand those to her when she comes back. To put that differently, when two government agencies have administrative rules which contradict each other or are inconsistent or produce unintended consequences, then the taxpayer should not be penalized by this tug of war between the agencies. The Senior and Disabled Services Division and the Department of Employment recognize that some of their agency administrative rules need review and closer joint coordination. The point is to avoid charging an employer's unemployment insurance reserve account for benefits paid to a claimant when the employer has followed exactly the procedural rules and instructions from SDSD. The statutes and SDSD rules say that under certain circumstances, an adult foster home cannot employ or retain in employment a person who cannot pass a criminal background examination. We agree with the rule, and we think it's a good one, but invoking this rule has an unintended result, which SDSD and the Department of Employment, my understanding, are willing to alleviate. 2698 addresses this problem, and Mr. Brent Voiter, on my right, would be happy to tell the committee about the case that triggered this bill.
Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Vader, and please introduce yourself and bring that microphone over, please. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm a member of the committee. I am Brent Voiter. I'm the owner of Voiter's Golden Horizon in Corvallis, Oregon, which spends most of its time with adult foster care homes. Upon renewal of one of our facility's licenses, we comply with the ORA rule concerning internal background checks on all current employees. When the license came back, we received a letter from SDSD saying that one of our employees did not pass the criminal background check. It, of course, was not divulged what the crime was that they had been convicted of, but that they would not be able to work in the home or be retained in the home. As I asked them concerning this matter, the licensor reminded me of the OAR rule, which says the provider will not hire or retain an employment or allow to be an occupant in a foster home when there's a resident or than a resident, any person who has the provider knows has been convicted of a disqualifying crime. The employee was then discharged as was required. The employee then went and filed for unemployment with the state of Oregon and was granted benefits. The conclusion of that finding was, quote, you were discharged but not for misconduct connected with your work. Your inability to pass the criminal check was not due to any willful or wrongfully negligent disregard of your employee's employer's interest. We then went and appealed this to the Employment Division, and that was granted. And the decision was reversed. And I quote, the administrative decision mailed December 18, 1998 is set aside. The claimant is subject to disqualification from benefits of ORS 657.176-2A until requalified under Employment Department law. I think there are sometimes related issues that can come up from this situation. Sometimes people say perhaps some crimes should not be considered, or tenure of time since the crime took place, or restitution took place. Those are important items, but we feel that it should not be part of this bill or consideration. Once the divisions in the state of Oregon come together and make a unified effort on what crimes are disqualifying from being a foster home, then we should be able to feel free to follow those rules and not feel like we'll be penalized for paying unemployment insurance because we had not opportunity to address them. Thank you.
Thank you. Question? Yes, Senator Byer.
Mr. Boyer, I'm trying to get clear in my mind. The person who this happened had been working for your business for a while and you were unaware, or did he they committed a crime before, or did it happen while in the employ?
When they were hired, they went through a crim check, and it was clear. From that next following year in employment, we went to relicense. They had committed and been convicted of a crime, and that's when it came to our attention when we went through for employment.
Convicted during your tenure of employment?
Correct. Once we learned of the disqualifying, I mean, once we learned of the item, then we went to the employee and asked if they'd be willing to discuss what it was, and they did. So it happened while they were employed.
Further questions? Yeah.
Mr. Chair, members, and Ned Talbot, Legislative Coordinator for the Employment Department. Just for the record, I was just talking with staff. We weren't aware of this case particularly. We have lots of different appeals taken, so and I don't believe that there was any testimony to this regard on the House side. So two things. One is that the bill generally only relates to relief of charges for an employer who has to discharge someone because they can't satisfy a job prerequisite. Representative Cruz, who testified in front of the House Committee, described the bill as very narrow, where there had actually been a change in administrative law or state administrative rule or state law, so that and that the person therefore couldn't qualify. I believe that the scenario that you just heard is a little bit different in the sense that the person wasn't even entitled to benefits because they actually, through misconduct of their own, seems to have denied themselves benefits because they committed a crime that would keep them, or some crime, I gather, would keep them from actually qualifying for the job that they had. So I think you have a little bit of apples and oranges. You don't have a problem with the bill as drafted, but it really is a bill that is only designed to allow relief of charges, whereas the scenario that was described, the person actually wasn't even qualified for benefits because they had committed some crime that, through their own doing, would actually disqualify them from benefits, not just relation to the charges. So I want to make it clear for the record that this bill deals with someone who is discharged through no fault of their own, that there's just a change in administrative rule or law while they're there that they somehow can't meet, whereas the other situation that was described, there's some misconduct on the person's part, and I just hope that that would be clear for the record.
Okay. Senator Byer.
No, I'm not clear.
Okay.
let me see if I can get this. If somebody becomes disqualified because the requisite that the government agency establishes makes them no longer eligible for a job, what this bill would do is say they are eligible for unemployment benefits, but the employer doesn't have to pay it. So the cost will be socialized?
Mr. Chair, Senator Byer, that's exactly correct.
Is that what this bill does?
That's what this bill does. It doesn't relate to benefits at all.
Okay. So in the other scenario where someone is working and during the term unknown to the employer, they committed a crime which made them ineligible, are they still eligible for benefits?
Well, Mr. Chair, I believe on appeal what they were found out, although I'm sorry that they had to appeal, that they found out that that was in fact misconduct connected with work and therefore they weren't even entitled to benefits, although not familiar with the specific case, I just based on what they said.
Under existing law, then Mr. Boyer's example, then the employer would not have been charged for that. Since there was no benefits paid, it wouldn't be charged for it.
If they were the most recent employer, that's correct. And discharged from misconduct, there's no benefits paid and no charges to the employer.
Mr. Chair, if I'm following the discussion, this is even a narrower bill than we envisioned to start with. And I think it's perhaps helpful to recognize that the whole crime involved was driving under the influence. So it wasn't on the scene, on the job type of abuse. compromise. It didn't pump at all. It was outside. And clearly the recorder had no ability to control that. So my understanding also is that the Inter Service Division and is going to coordinate their administrative rules to the state and better. And if there's not a consistency or conflict in the rules,
needed this particular piece of legislation that protects the employees and service on somebody in charge. And this is the case.
It sounds like your client was already covered under existing law. So maybe it's a misunderstanding. It was already covered.
Yeah, indicated that that would be the case.
Okay.
But the ruling of the
first place was apparently contrary, because the person was awarded benefits and the employer had to appeal for an administrative hearing in order to straighten the matter out.
I see.
And so it was subsequent to all of that that this bill came into the need for it came into view.
That would probably still happen because unless challenged by the employer, the employment department is going to go on what the employee puts down in their file for a claim. And they would have no way to know that unless the employer challenged that.
Correct.
It's a normal process. How would this work, Annette, in terms of if an employer, I don't mean to pick on you, but chose to hire somebody without doing the background check first, had them work in a couple of weeks to check them back, and they couldn't work?
Mr. Chair, Senator Byler, that's a good question, because what we would do is the employer is required when they seek relief of charges to put down why they're requesting that. So we would expect that they put down something specific enough that we could tell that, in fact, let's say the criminal background check was just required now, and they had the person on staff, and then they couldn't pass, and they had to let them go. That would be a new requirement that they have to be in that job, and if they couldn't meet it, they could discharge them through no fault of their own. Again, they didn't have that prerequisite when they got the job in the first instance. They would be entitled to benefits, but the employer could seek relief and say, the state law changed, and now all my employees have to pass this background check. And we'd say, okay, then those costs would go to the employer pool instead of a person's account directly. So that's one example. Another example is child care workers. Some of them are going to, if legislation passes session, be required to take additional training. If they couldn't meet those additional training requirements for whatever reason, again, the employer would then have the option to let them go and ask for relief of charges.
I'm thinking in terms of someone like that. I don't mean to start your company at all, but someone who just out there chose not to, for whatever, an emergency put somebody on before they did the background check and then found out. Would they be liable for anything?
Mr. Chair, I think that would be up to the staff to review for the relief of charge request to see if, in fact, there had been a true change in the prerequisite as opposed to a failure to perhaps enforce the prerequisite.
They just failed to enforce them, would be liable. Okay.
That would be how we would interpret the bill as drafted, Mr. Chair, if you know.
Mr. Wendy, you had a comment?
One comment was in foster homes, we have to have that kind of check prior to them either starting training or on the premises in our arena. And so employers better do it before they come on.
Mr. Chair, just for the record, too, I'll be glad to look into the specific case to see if there's any other issues that aren't addressed by this bill, now that I know about it.
Further questions? Thank you. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2698. Open up the work session, House Bill 2698. Chair would move it to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Comments? Objections? Order. They have a carrier. Senator Stone. We're going back. Open up a public hearing on House Bill 2978, more unemployment insurance. And Annette, better just stay right up here close. Huh?
Mr. Chair, Nat Talbot, Legislative Coordinator for the Employment Department. Representative Williams did a great job describing this bill. We did work with him, as he indicated, because we didn't want to be out of conformity with the federal law. We still do require that all employers report quarterly, but we finally refer to these statutes as pop-up statutes, so that if the federal law allows us to do it, we'll be in place. And then we can get it going and allow annual reporting for domestic employers.
Don't we, every session or every so often, pass a bill that says that we will be in compliance with the federal law, state law, in compliance with federal tax law? I mean, this doesn't affect this?
This doesn't affect us, Mr. Chair. The Department of Labor reviews every piece of unemployment insurance legislation that this body looks at and passes to see if we are still in conformity with federal law. So we send all of our legislation up to the regional office for that review, just so this committee knows if we get out of conformity, sometimes that will mean we lose $90 million of an administrative grant to run the department. And the actual larger conformity issue is a $900 million biennium increase in employer taxes if they aren't allowed the offset that they now get under their federal tax they pay. So we watch those conformity issues carefully because we don't want to see a $990 million impact from one small bill. So if you hear us talk about conformity issues in the future, that's very much what we worry about, is that we don't cause employers to lose their federal offset and or lose our grant to administer the program. So this goes in conformity with the law and the federal law. And it's, federal legislation has been introduced to actually allow this quarterly reporting if this has been successful. So if it does pass at some future time, we'll be able to adopt it quickly in conjunction with the other agencies that we do our tax reporting with.
Okay, so do you have any questions? Close public hearing on House Bill 2978, open up a work session on House Bill 2978. Chair would move to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Comments? Objections? Orders. I guess, okay. Okay, open up a public hearing on House Bill 2316. Jim and Matt and Jim Kruger. Welcome, John.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Jim Marquis on behalf of the Oregon Collectors Association. House Bill 2316 was introduced by the Interim Judiciary Committee at the request of the Oregon Collectors Association. It was passed out by the House Civil Judiciary Committee unanimously and passed the House unanimously. The bill is what I would consider a technical fix, although we did amend the bill in the House. In 1995, the legislature rewrote the Collection Agency Act, Chapter 697 of the ORF. They adopted a new definition of a collection agency. A collection agency was defined as any individual collecting a debt for another person, and then person was defined to include an individual, a corporation, a partnership, etc. But included in the definition of a person was not a state agency or a public agency. And so shortly after the 95 session, the Scholarship Commission requested an Attorney General's opinion, which you're getting a copy of, asking whether they could use then collection agencies which were not registered with the state of Oregon or regulated. And the answer was yes, because of that definition. This bill simply adds public agencies to the definition of person, so that a collection agency who was only doing collections for a public agency would be required to be registered and regulated by the state, just as if they were collecting for anyone else. Higher Ed had testified in the House about this bill, and they have used some agencies that were not registered with the state And they were concerned about, while those agencies, I believe, didn't mind getting registered, they were concerned about the requirement in Oregon that an agency have an in-state office and an in-state trust account. And the amendment that was adopted in the House allows the Department of Consumer and Business Services to waive those requirements if they deem that a particular agency is adequately regulated without those provisions. And Mr. Kruger is here with the department to speak to that if you have any questions about it.
For the record, my name is James Kruger. I'm the program manager for the collection agency program. The amendments that allow us to waive the in-state office requirement and trust account requirement were actually a part of a bill that was dropped by the agency and adapted as an amendment to this bill. It would be our intent to exempt from that requirement those very agencies that higher ed have qualified as collectors for their program, because clearly they have the experience and they have the reputation that would warrant such an exemption. And I think it's important we put that on the record so that the department's intent is clearly stated. With that, if you have any other questions, I'll be happy to answer.
Questions?
Mr. Chair, I believe that with this amendment, no one in the building is supposed to be
stoned. It was already amended in the House. The amendment took place in the House.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
I didn't see one here for us. We're in good shape then. Further questions? Close public hearing. On House Bill 2316, open up a work session on House Bill 2316. And the Chair would move before we pass recommendation. Any comments? Objections? So order. The carrier. Is there a local carrier there?
Charles.
Charles? Yeah. Charles, all right. We'll do that. Okay, very good. That's where we're going. Open up a public hearing on House Bill 3308. And Representative Thompson, are you close to me?
Thank you, Terry Thompson, House District 4. House Bill 3308 solves a problem that's plagued the fishing industry, certain aspects of the fishing industry, for years. What's gone on is because of weather in the winter months and the irregularity of the times you can go fishing, it's been difficult to deal with unemployment insurance for boats that fish year-round. The original law was passed by some salmon trawlers back about 25 years ago to allow them to fish in the summer months and then collect unemployment in the winter. But for some boats, like trawl fishermen for ground fish, it's very difficult because of the irregularity. You go a month and then you go a short trip for 2 or 3 days, and your crew says, well, I want to collect unemployment. I don't want to collect unemployment. It gets to be a real problem inside the industry. So a group of fishermen met and worked with the unemployment office for, I guess, 2 or 3 weeks there on different meetings, and we came up with this bill, which is what makes it optional to opt out of the unemployment insurance for certain vessels. It brings it to what the federal standard is, as it is now inside the, for fishermen don't have to pay unemployment insurance and we don't pay quarterly. We're the same as agriculture. But in this state, we are covered on unemployment insurance. In other states, that's your Alaska, you're not. And that's what this law is designed to be equivalent to the Alaska law. And I'll let Jeanette open that.
Mr. Chair, Annette Talbot, the Legislative Coordinator for the Employment Department. House Bill 3308, we did work with Representative Thompson on this bill. This bill is a very narrow exception to unemployment insurance law for specific types of very small boats where there's a crew of fewer than 10 individuals. So where they only receive a share of the catch as their remuneration. That's the only thing that they're getting for purposes of the fishing duties, and they don't receive any other cash for these duties. The department has remained neutral on this proposal because there are three federal laws that also treat these small crews who only receive the share of the catch as non-employees. So both the federal unemployment insurance law, the federal income tax withholding law, and Social Security or FICA treat these individuals as if they're not employees. And for that reason, the department has remained neutral on the proposal because it is such a narrow exclusion. And we'd be glad to answer any questions.
So, the farmer couldn't do this because the farm workers don't have a share of the catch. I want to make sure that the farmer is well protected.
Well, I can answer your question. But on the boats, it's, in certain fisheries, it's in tradition to always work on a percentage basis of the catch. And so I know my boat has, and the crew just takes, each crewman takes 10% of the catch, and the captain takes 15 or 16%. And what, if we make money, it's fine. If we don't, they're in trouble too.
Mr. Chair, also for the record, the way the bill is drafted is it basically excludes those employees from an unemployment insurance coverage, but employers are allowed to opt into the system to cover. So just wanted to clarify that. That's how the opt-in works. And as Representative Thompson had told us, you know, certain fishermen may certainly want to cover their employees if they so desire, and they're certainly free to do that if they like.
I do believe that there probably won't be too many people opt out. I think most people stay in, but there are certain boats and certain operations that make it real difficult, especially the real small draggers, the 50-footers, that don't have the option to fish very often in the tough weather in the wintertime, and they get in some real messes with trying to keep, whether they're on or whether or not, whether the crew's going to go or not, and they say, one of our biggest problems is it actually becomes a case of unemployment becomes the adversary to keeping the crew on board, because it's easier to go sitting home and collect unemployment than it is to go fishing and not make much money. So in that case, for some of those small boats, they might opt out.
Okay. Very good. Any questions? Thank you. Close public hearing on House Bill 3308. Open up work session on House Bill 3308. Chair would move the floor with the due pass recommendation. Comments? Objections? So ordered. Chair, I'll carry that one. I'll put the farmer fisherman bill. Whatever that means.
Fish party.
This fishing bill. Oh. Welcome. I'm going to reopen the public hearing on House Bill 3098. Okay, it's all sharing plenum. Excuse me. Sharon, Simon, Barbara Barrett, John Vanderland and Ham, and Emily Suterly. Okay. You're welcome. And who wants to start out here with all this?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Van Laningham, and I work as a lawyer for a nonprofit in Eugene called Lane County Law and Advocacy. I'm here to testify in favor of House Bill 3098A, as well as the Dash 9, Dash 10, and Dash 11 amendments, all of which are coalition support. 3098 is a companion bill to Senate Bill 1088, which this committee considered and passed out unanimously, I believe, 2 weeks ago, is now pending on the Senate floor. 3098, the bill that's before you today, was negotiated by a group of landlords and tenants. Both bills were negotiated by groups of landlords and tenants. I'm giving you a 23-page memo, which I expect you all to read now and be closed on.
You didn't put your name on it. I don't see your name.
That's part of the trick.
That's part of the trick, yeah.
What this document does is explain to the legislators as well as future users of the amendment what the negotiation group is trying to do with this bill. what the changes do, and what the intent is. So it allows us in the future, as we go out in the real world and deal with real landlords and real tenants and real realtors, to say, this is what the language means, says, but this is also what we meant when we were working this up. So we hope that it will be helpful, not just to you all, although I know that you can't read it while I'm talking to you, or maybe you can.
many powers in the
It allows people out there in the rest of Oregon to use it in the future. The negotiating group for this bill, 3098, met 22 times over an 8-month period in 1998 and 1999. And each of those meetings lasted at least 3, sometimes painful, hours. The members of that group who are here today to support the bill include Emily C. Lee from Multifamily Housing Council, Sharon Barrett, Clinton Barrett, I can't omit Sharon's hyphen, from Oregon Mental Housing Association, as well as her board president, Norton Cabell, who's in the audience, Sally Harrington from Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon, David Niebel from the Oregon Law Center, Pat Schwab from the Oregon State Tennis Association, and Manufactured Homeowners of Oregon. And those meetings were facilitated by Dave Shelar from the State Housing Community Services Department. A separate work group with some membership overlap negotiated what became 1088, the bill you've already passed. That group included additional members such as Don Miner from Oregon Manufactured Housing Industries is here today, and Frank Burleson, who is a park has been a park resident and advocate for the park tenants, who's here today. That group also included a number of lenders from Washington Mutual and Reliable Credit. You will, I believe, hear testimony later today from park landlords who are in opposition to Section 2B of this bill, 3098. 2B is what the issue that we in the work group call termination and removal.
Proposed amendments?
No, sir. It's in the actual main part.
What is the page in the...
One through... Two videos on the first and the first page of House Bill 39.
Okay.
A couple of points about that subsection. This subsection, as amended by the Dash 9, to make some technical corrections as Representative Beyer pointed out to you earlier today, that section is identical to the section we already passed 2 weeks ago in Senate Bill 1088. You heard testimony in opposition to the termination and removal issue 2 weeks ago. You will, I believe, hear similar testimony today. I would be glad to respond to any questions that testimony raises for you. I don't want to take your time now anticipating those objections, but I'm sure you'll hear them, and I'd be glad to come back and talk about them if you want, if you have questions about them.
We'll give you that opportunity. Senator Byer has a question.
There, if you have there here some that swap, I think we'll be speaking later. 2B, as it exists in the English version, is it consistent with 1088 or is it inconsistent?
Chair, Senator Beyer, it will be exactly consistent with the Dash 9 amendment.
Okay.
The Dash 9 amendment. We've been juggling various versions of the bill because Legislative Council changes things. And so I have a hard time keeping track with what Legislative Council is doing. And so the Dash 9 amendment corrects some changes that Legislative Council made in the earlier version to make sure that they are identical. We certainly don't want to end up in the session with both bills passing and there being inconsistency. So with the Dash 9 amendments, termination and removal issues will be identical in both bills.
So the agreed upon changes that are in the amendments have the general support of the coalition.
Chair Senator Beyer, they have the enthusiastic and overwhelming support of the coalition, which has been through some hard times.
Okay.
This is that as you may recall, I'm not sure, Senator Beyer, if you were in the room last time when we talked about this. That issue went through 15 drafts. Was reviewed by a work group of close to 20 people, including 5 different lawyers, and changed significantly over time. But it's been worked and worked and worked. There are, the rest of House Bill 3098 has to do with non-manufactured housing tenancies in general, although the way the law works, that also applies to manufactured housing tenancies. There are 35 substantive sections. Rather than take your time by reviewing those 35 substantive sections, I'd be glad to answer questions.
Okay.
And my testimony there.
Further questions? from the committee? Sharon, who wants to do first here?
Well, Sharon Fleming here, representing the Oregon Rental Housing Association and the Oregon Apartment Association and its 3,500 members statewide. House Bill 3098 is enthusiastically supported by all of our members of our group. We did spend many months, as John described, working on the legislation. Everybody gets something. That's the beauty of all of us working together to make the changes to the law. We all bring our wish list to the table, and we negotiate from there. And there are good things for landlords in this bill. There are good things for tenants in this bill. And more importantly, there are very many, many good things for the housing industry in total. We urge your support of 3098A-9-10 and 11 amendments. I'm not going to read you the rest of my testimony. It speaks for itself.
Thank you very much, Emily.
I'm Emily Seeley, the Executive Director of Multifamily Housing Council, a similar organization in the state with 4,700 members statewide, representing over 350,000 rental units. I was around in 1981 when we started making changes to landlord-tenant and spent committee time fighting with legal aid in hearings. When then Representative Springer threw his pencil down on the table and said, I've had it, go out in the hall and fight, and when you come back, we'll talk about it. It then merged into Michael Marcus of Legal Aid and myself, Jenny Mahaly on marble floors, trying to write upside down on a wall with a piece of pencil of paper and a pen that wouldn't work, until we started meeting in more general locations, and now we have up to 16 people at the table at a time trying to work out these changes. And as we've all said, it is a long, arduous process. Everybody has grand hopes when we start, and we end up with realism. And urge your support of the bill with the amendments, recognizing that there are things in here that do upset some landlords. But my goal, as I've worked since 1980, is to protect housing. When things offend or hurt landlords, it's wrong for housing. When things offend tenants, it's wrong for housing, and ultimately housing affordability suffers. This is a good balance. It doesn't put tenants in a position of being second-class citizens, and it does the best we can to make sure that the rights and responsibilities of landlords are protected.
Questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. You're going to post a hand that take all of you. Joe Bruce, Mike Dewey, Don Miner, Pat Slark, and Frank Burleson. Kind of get close to the idea.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Mike Dewey with the Oregon Cable Telecommunications Association. I bring to you the -11 amendment, and I apologize for not bringing this issue up. On the House side, I was not aware, quite frankly, that they were making some changes on page 14 and 15 of the bill, and we are asking that the definition of cable television actually be expanded, or video services be expanded to direct satellite or other video subscription service. And the reason we're asking this is that the FCC, in a recent ruling, provides that the landlord ultimately can own the what we call the home-run wiring, the wiring within the complex, not the wiring outside the complex. And we thought that with the new verbiage, and actually the verbiage from 1997, that the DBS, Direct Broadcast Satellite Provider, had somewhat of an unfair competitive advantage in terms of pricing the service and how a landlord, therefore, could price the service. In other words, a salesperson would come and say, we can get you a better deal, we can mark it up higher, and the idea is for that not to occur. We're talking about the same services. So we thought the term cable television should be enlarged to provide for the other video services. Today there's not a definition, as I was looking at the statutes, of cable television, to the best of my knowledge, in the statute, albeit there are two bills working their way through the process to do that. And with that definition, it would make it problematic for us and my client. So that's why we've asked to have this amendment considered. We don't believe it's going to do any harm to the bill, and actually I think it's in the best interest of the tenant. Thank you. Do you have any questions?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
For the record, my name is Jill Bruce. I'm an attorney from the Portland law firm of Preston Gates and Ellis, and here on behalf of the client who's a manufactured home park owner. I submitted a letter to the committee, not anticipating that I'd actually be here to testify today. And rather than repeat what's in that letter, let me just state my overall concern and also make one clarification of an error. I understand that Paul Phillips will not be offering testimony today, but I think that you have heard some of him express some of the park owners' concerns generally. And the bottom line concern for me, and I'm kind of new to reading these bills and what's happened up to this point, but is that there seems to be a big shift of control via Section 2B in the bill from park owners to manufactured dwelling owners. And I know that in other states there have been concerns raised, as there have in Oregon, on takings issues. And to the extent this Section 2B or some of the language in 2B creates what I've called perpetual tenancies, I came here today and again via my letter posed the question of whether the committee has satisfied itself and really looked at the language sufficiently in 2B to make sure that there isn't a shift in property rights, if you will, between the park owners and the manufactured dwelling owners.
Okay. Questions?
Comments? Don. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Don Miner. I'm here on behalf of Oregon Manufactured Housing Association to speak in support of this legislation, as well as the amendments that have been prepared by John Van Langingham. More manufactured homes are produced in Oregon than any state west of Texas. Members of our association provide about 30% of all new single-family homes sold in the state. We're very successful here, and we think the most important ingredient to that success is the satisfaction of our consumers, including those who place homes in manufactured home parks. We think that Section 2A and the remainder of that provision are very much needed. Let me describe the problem. A person buys a manufactured home. It's a new home or it's a home that exists, and that home is placed in a park. A person either pays cash for it or he finances it. Sometime thereafter, he wants to sell the home. The owner's circumstances may have changed. They want to take a job elsewhere, or they're older and they need to move on. Or they just want to buy a better home and trade their equity. They go to the park owner and inform him that they intend to sell the home. In some cases, park owners at that point inform the consumer that you can sell the home, the person that buys it from you can leave it there. But when that person sells it, it has to be removed. No one's going to buy the home under those circumstances, or if they do buy it, it's going to be at a steep discount. The original owner then finds that his equity in his home has been compromised. If the home has been financed, the lender's security has been compromised. What this language will do is allow that person to leave the home and sell it, and the person buying it can leave it there and sell it, so long as they maintain the home in good condition. If the home is not maintained in good condition, the landlord can tell the resident tenant, make repairs. If the repairs aren't made, the home has to move. We think this balances the competing interests of park owners and consumers, and at the same time protects the expectations of folks who finance manufactured homes, and we think this provision is very much needed and we support it.
Questions? Okay, thank you. Pat and Frank, we need to keep those folks to just stay close there. Welcome. Please introduce yourself.
My name is Pat Schwab. I represent Manufactured Homeowners of Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on this. As has been previously stated, we spent months working on the issues that are involved in this bill and trying to reach a resolution that would be fair to everybody, landlords and residents alike. We feel that this bill has kind of clarified several issues that have been concerned to both sides. One of the issues for residents is the protection for a resident who owns a well-maintained home having to be removed from a park because of age, size, style, or original construction material. The protection is offered under Section 2 of this bill. This has been a very real problem for residents and has had the effect of reducing the value of perfectly good homes to salvage. In many cases, this is the only thing of value that the owner has left. We understand from hearing on 1088 that there are some park owners who are gnashing their teeth regarding this bill, that it will force them to make units which are in disrepair leave their parks when the owner has been content to let the home stay in the park. I've read this section over carefully, and I can't find a provision any place for a trailer house mobile manufactured home cop who will come in and tell the park owner that he must remove a house if the park owner wishes it to remain. For the benevolent park owner, this bill hasn't changed that effort. We urge a vote to move this bill to the Senate floor for with a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We do have a little bit of time to show you, so if you can condense your testimony, I'd sure appreciate it. Please introduce yourself.
Yes, Frank Burrell, Residents Coalition. I got so many microphones.
Yeah,
you I just want to comment briefly. I want to add one historical footnote to all of this. Everybody's been making much of the fact that this bill has been under consideration for a couple of legislative sessions. And I just wanted to tell you that after the 1995 legislative session, we resident representatives got together and formulated the Residents Coalition. Had a much longer name, but we don't have to go to that. I wrote position paper number one, and guess what? It was on forced removal. That was our major consideration then, outside of increasing rents. And it's our major consideration now. It's still going on. Now, I want to answer the suggestion that the young lawyer gave you from the last group, that perhaps this is a change in property rights from the park owner to the park resident. And I don't think that it is such a change, but if it was, perhaps it reflects the fact that if you go to any tax assessor's office, you will see that the accumulative contribution to any given mobile home park, be it large or small, is anywhere from of the residents, the accumulative tax assessments for the residents, is anywhere from 45% to 65% larger than the investment that the park owner has in that park. And I think this is a very interesting statistic. I did not arrive at that from a statewide survey. You know, I'm retired. I'm a volunteer for them. I don't have any business network or anything to. But the parks, the several parks that I did, they all sell within this group, and I think that's very interesting. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Sally Harrington, and I'm legislative chair for the Manufactured Housing Community of Oregon, which represents over 500 park owners in the state of Oregon. I participated in this coalition as well as the coalition for Senate Bill 1088, and would appreciate your support with a due pass to the floor on this bill and all the amendments. Thank you.
And the concern, I guess, from another group is that the shift in 2B from the landowner to the tenant creates a perpetual tenancy. Do you have any concerns or fears about that?
No, I don't, because basically what they have right now is they're talking about a subsequent sale where the home can be removed. The law allows for the landlord to give a 30-day with up to a 60-day extension to remove the home for disrepair of the exterior of the mobile home, so that they would still have the allowed to be able, would be able allowed to upgrade their park if the home is in deteriorating condition.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Absolutely. We have now, I think the group that's here in opposition, Paul Cook, John McDermott, Helen Connolly, Gerald Schaff, is that right? Myron Corcoran, Mark Bush, Beverly and Wayne Hellenbrand, and Patricia Dorner. If, I think all you folks who signed up in opposition, if there's one person that could be a spokesman and could summarize or put those things forth, and then if somebody has something to add, it's going to give you an opportunity to do that. We just have another committee coming here at 3 o'clock. That's our problem, and I want to make sure that... Welcome, gentlemen. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Paul Cook, spelled K-O-C-H, 17414 Southeast Oakfield Road, Milwaukee, Oregon. I did not come here with the intention of assuming any leadership position or attempt to speak on behalf of my peers and associates behind me, but I'd be happy to address you first in regard to concerns that I have, recognizing that some of these parks have a little different characteristic, and some of them will have different issues to be concerned about. In my particular case, I have three parks that are modest, predominantly older homes, but we try to keep them in good maintenance order, and we're happy, for the most part, for our tenants, and I appreciate them. On the other hand, I have some that I'm not at least as happy about, and unfortunately, with the advent of the 1989 Fair Housing Act, the composition of our parks has changed dramatically. Whether all of us would recognize it or acknowledge it, I don't know, but I have to tell you, I think the concept of our tenants has changed, family definition has changed, and the relationships that constitute the family has changed. Consequently, our problems are much different than they were. But we do have cases, and they are significant, wherein our tenants do not maintain their homes simply because of they've got some of these strange relationships. We have some who have problems with alcohol. We have some that have problems with drugs. We have more children in our parks. These have become fair game for these kinds of activities. And this bill gives us some difficult situations with which to work addressing these issues. In my case, I've had cases where alcohol involved. Afternoons, the children after school are invited into the home. Same thing with drugs. And I can see this bill allowing the perpetuation of that, in as much as, we may evict the original offender. And we may have to, and we do apparently under this bill, have to keep the home there. The possibility of entering into any meaningful dialogue with that person is impossible, at best remote. All he has to do is sell it to his successor, who comes to us with, a relatively good, healthy bank account, and not much else. And under the concern for discrimination, I think we fall a victim of that, and the whole process starts all over again. And so there are some real concerns I have. And in my mind, there is an element of guaranteeing the continuance of some kind of slum characteristics, which all of us, I think, have tried to eliminate. It frees the irresponsible tenant, after he leaves the park, from his obligation. I see no way to engage in a reasonable judgment and a common agreement on what constitutes adequate and reasonable repair. There is no reference in this bill to park standards, and I see no great difference in trying to deal with this person as with someone that has been evicted from an apartment building that has been, the apartment has been trashed. Granted, they've got a home sitting there, and I understand that. Now, I think, for instance, the fire and police departments would object to some of these bills. I think there's some of the features of this bill. It is my position that the costs that are involved in handling these instances, the eviction, and dealing with the subsequent fallout of it, that cost falls to the remaining tenants. And I see no justification or rationale for that. On the other hand, I have to tell you that amongst my friends and peers and so on that are engaged in this, in their little home park ownership, I find all of these people interested in upgrading their parks, maintaining a good relationship. They solicit their tenants and try to do a fair job of applying the rules and regulations and the landlord-tenant obligations. My final comment would be, having been raised the way I have, which I appreciate beyond measure, and the opportunities that have been afforded to me, but I have to tell you, I resent very much the fact that this encroaches my rights as a property owner. It attacks my opportunity to use my property in a measure in a way that I judge as beneficial to me and my family. And I do think it has some overtones for constitutionality, and I predict that you will be sitting one day in the presence of some who will be arguing the constitutionality of this measure today. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. Director of the committee. My name is John McDermott. I live in Central Point. I own 100 Space Mobile Home Park. I got a little anecdote that might be helpful to give some history on how this problem might work out in the future. I bought my first home in 1969. It was a 7x24-foot trailer. I lived in it for 4 years. I parked it on the west bank of the Sacramento River in a trailer park underneath the freeway while I worked in Sacramento. My next home was a condemned duplex in San Francisco. The city of San Francisco had a novel idea. Rather than tear down the seedy housing, they'd go through, write up all the code violations, and then make money available for folks to improve it. The whole neighborhood gets improved. You own your own home, and that way you take care of it. I didn't qualify for any of the monies because I had a duplex. But I improved my duplex, as did the whole neighborhood. We had a Renaissance neighborhood. What happened to the old travel trailer? The park it was in got tore down in West Sacramento. Since it was near the freeway, I could monitor its history. It was old trailer. And I don't know the owner's motivation to cease operation, but I can tell you the land was vacant for many years. The cost of operating an old park with no upside had to outweigh the income. It's really quite simple. No improvement, shortened life, housing stock is gone. If you see to see the marketplace with forced retention of old homes, you know, some folks are calling this a forced removal bill. It's not a forced removal bill. It's a forced retention bill. You could be eliminating spaces as well as homes. In my park was built in the early 70s. We have a 10-foot wide home, probably built in the 60s, that we are literally waiting for the old man to die before we move that home out of the park. It's right across the street. There are two brand new homes. They're looking at this 10-foot wide home. And they are concerned about that home. The people beside it are concerned about that home. I went to visit him the other day. He was way late on his rent. I walked in and spoke to him. He's heating that home with the burners on his stove. He probably doesn't have the amperage to run electric heat. But he's senile. He probably wouldn't turn it on anyway. He's so senile, I went in to chat with him. He says, "You're working hard?" "No, not too hard." He said, "Good, I know that son of a bitch that owns this place. I wouldn't work hard either." He's a wonderful man. He's a World War II veteran, and he deserves to live there as quiet and happy as he can till the end of his life. But why do I have to keep that small trailer in my park for the benefit of his heirs? Now, you can say that your bill says that we have to we have the opportunity to upgrade it and all that. But here comes the lawyers. I'm going to have to bring an electrician in there to say it's unsafe. The heirs can hire an electrician that says it is safe. At the very least, I'm going to get accused of trying to remove that home because it's old, not because it's unsafe. And you're going to put me in a position where we're going to have a bank of lawyers and a bank of electricians to remove that home. These homes were never built to last forever. They were pre-76 when the code was entirely different on them. The walls are thin, the wiring's inadequate. They're not meant to last forever, and you're making us create a spot for them forever. And thank you very much for an opportunity.
Thank you very much, sir.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Senators and committee members, for hearing this here today. My name's Alan Conway. I have a 73 Space Park in Lynn County near Albany. First off, I'd like to dispel a myth about us rotten rat-fence landlords, is we don't wake up in the morning trying to find a way to evict people. It just doesn't make any financial sense for me to say, well, let's see if I can kick somebody out and reduce my cash flow here. So that's not our goal in life. And then this business about fair housing, when we get a vacancy, we have to quake in our shoes that we don't screw up and get caught violating the fair housing business when we fill that space back. So I just wanted to address that. Now, as this bill provides in Section 2, is we cannot get rid of these old houses forever as long as we can't stay there in such bad shape. Well, my original part of my park started in 1968. I still have some of those 10 wives in there, some of them with the original residents. Those houses have gotten old, and those residents have gotten old over this 30-plus years. Neither are in very good shape today. Now, under this bill, I'm provided with the opportunity to go in and tell these 85-year-old widows, well, I'm afraid you can't live here anymore because you can't maintain your house. I have written agreements with some of these folks that we will help them along, we'll replace their deck, we'll do things for them, so then when the day comes that they no longer need that house, it can be removed from the park. That's another issue in this bill. It says here that any of these conditions or agreements, contracts that we've made, they're null and void now. Just wipes all that out. What happens to contractual agreements here?
What section was that in the bill?
That's, let's see here. That is, I'm sorry, I've lost that. If it's not missing, it's in the companion bill. 2C, okay. I'm sorry, in the heat of the moment here, I lost that. We've been helping some of these folks remain in their homes for years. This eliminates that as an option, really, because if we can't get rid of this house downstream someday, if we don't have a vision that someday we can get rid of it, then our option is to tell these people get out now, getting 30 days notice to fix it up or get out. I don't think that's what you intend. It's darn sure not what I want. But it's whatever reason, it's what these people are doing to us here. And incidentally, we talk about the coalition that's gotten together and done all this. That's a handful of people, maybe 20 people. Well, there's about 1,400 mobile home parks in this state. You haven't heard all their voices, but anyway, there's about 60,000, 65,000 mobile homes in parks in this state. I'll assure you, you haven't heard all their voices on this issue. This impacts everybody. It impacts the people that are going to be faced with an eviction rather than just riding it out till they're done with it. It impacts the people that's going to have to live across the street or next door to these units forever. And then there's another little issue that hasn't been talked about here. There's a little business when we sell the new homes in this industry that most of them are sold with no debt. I won't say most, but there's a practice of selling these houses with no down payment. If you've got a credit card, I'll sell you a house. We'll move it in over here and maybe even give you a teaser rate on the interest for a period of time, maybe even pay your rent for a year. So these people buy the house, move it into a site. There's another little thing put on called crack. And that includes the setup, that calls the skirting, the sidewalks, the carports, the awnings. Maybe it's $15,000 to $25,000 pack is put on this house. So from the day that resident moves in that house, he's in it upside down on his equity. They talk about you can't sell them for fear of having to move them out. They can't sell them because they've got a loan on them bigger than they're worth. And that's the truth of it. And right now, there's somewhere from 500 to I don't know how many, maybe 1,000 houses in this state that are repoed or abandoned right now because of these trans practices on financing. People can't sell them. Brand new, maybe 2 years, 3 years old. They can't sell them because they owe more than they're worth, and they move out and abandon them. And now that portion of our industry would make sure that we, the residents of the parks and the management of the parks, would be stuck with the wreckage of their wild way that they're financing and selling these units.
Okay, so the gist of the testimony, they're objecting about 2B and 2C.
2B and 2C, yes. So there's other things, little minor things that we can get and take on, but this is the thing. We've fought for 25 years to change our image from trailer park, trailer trash, to middle class family and residential living, places to retire, places to raise your family. But sticking us with this, and the death spiral we're going to have on these repossessed houses, being people put back in them that can't qualify to live there, we're going to be trailer park trash again. That's where we're headed with this. I'm urging you to put this thing on hold and investigate what I'm telling you. There's more here than anybody can see.
Thank you very much. Another gentleman will do this. Do you have something to add to this? Could you introduce yourself for the record, please?
My name is Gerald Bosch, and I'm from Mexico, Oregon. These gentlemen talked about 1968 and 1970. I own one park that was built in 1940. I have many older homes in there, and some of them are 6 foot wide. And some 4 to 8 foot long. Well, composition, old kind of. That's not something I want to do.
Sure.
So think about this real hard. You're talking about not just another home or manufactured housing. You're condemning an awful lot of trailers, either on us or on the nation.
Okay. Thank you very much.
A lot of trailers in the country. Those are the people that are in.
Okay. Thank you very much.
This was very directly done without any discussion. They don't know how to impress that on them. This is terribly different. And maybe our coalition members, this is what it is.
Mr. Chairman, I would ask that you give an opportunity for Mr. Bush to speak. Mr. Bush is an attorney and comes at this with a little different perspective in this particular address the language.
Okay.
I appreciate that.
Mr. Bush. Thank you. We have your written testimony, so you can hit us with the straight facts.
Sure. For the record, my name is Mark Bush. I'm an attorney in Portland, and I represent a number of manufacturers in all parts throughout the state. And a number of my clients have expressed their concern with Section 2A, 2B, and 2C of House Bill 3098 for many of the reasons that you just heard. I took a little different angle on it in my written testimony. Some of the practical problems I see as a practitioner enforcing this law once you end up in front of a judge, because as my written comments point out, there are a number of ambiguities, and an earlier speaker pointed out that you're going to have a bank of lawyers arguing over it, and I'd have to agree. I think there's some problems with the way the bill is written. I'd leave many issues to be determined only by a trial judge once you get to trial, over whether a correction notice was, or a 30-day notice was properly given, whether it was specific enough, then it has an opportunity to come back and say, I've corrected the problem. The landlord has to respond to that in writing, saying no, you didn't, and the only way you'll ever get that figured out is in front of the judge. So, again, in addition to the problems that the earlier speakers pointed out, I wanted the committee to be aware of those problems.
Okay. Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Thank you very much. We are running out of time. John, you have an opportunity. You want an opportunity to rebut some of these. I apologize to some of the witnesses that weren't able to speak. But we do have another committee coming in here, and we're talking about 2A, 2B, and 2C that these folks are objecting to. Sure. Comment to those.
Yes, Mr. Chair. John Van Laningham, for the record. Just responding again to those issues. We discussed those issues in the committee 2 weeks ago at length, gave you responses then. All the issues that have been raised were debated at length in the negotiating group. As I said, we went through 15 drafts reviewed by 5 different lawyers. We've hashed these out, and this is a compromise intended to protect the rights of landlords, tenants, lenders, and the people who manufacture these homes. To be let me give you an example. Ms. Bruce has raised the concern that the extension is open-ended. The extension language says that if the tenant requests it, the tenant can get an extension of up to 60 days to repair the condition which has caused the landlord to give a 30-day eviction notice. A landlord can terminate a tenancy and require the removal of a home under this bill for the first time, clearly, if the home is in disrepair. Not because the tenant did something wrong, but just because the home is in disrepair. The disrepair could be peeling paint. We're not causing anybody to maintain rundown homes here. If there's peeling paint, a landlord can give a 30-day for-cause termination notice. Have you ever imagined trying to fix the paint on a manufactured home in November in Oregon? So we consider it an extension, because it's going to be darn hard to get a home repainted in November. We actually started off with an extension of, I think, 180 days and went to 60. We say at least 60 days because judges in this state have said if a statute says a certain number of days and a landlord gets more than that time, the notice is no good. We want to allow landlords to get more than that time if they wish. That would be absolutely discretionary with the landlord. The landlord would not be required to give more than 60 days for the extension. If a home is dangerous, if somebody's heating with their stove, that's a home that's dangerous. You can terminate under this provision, clearly, for the first time. There is no statute existing in the Landlord Tenant Act now that says clearly you can do that. We're now saying that for the first time. We're not taking the landlord's property. A landlord can terminate this tenancy because the tenant does something wrong, because the tenant doesn't pay the rent. There is no rent control in the state. Landlords can charge what they want for these space rent. The landlord can close the park and use it for another use. As I said, this is something that we have worked at great length over dozens of meetings to try to reach a balance that protects the rights of everybody. Does that answer questions?
Questions from anybody? We have dash 8, 9, 10, 11.
9, 10, 11, 8, 9,
11. I better close the public hearing and open up the work session.
Mr. Chair, we have a dash 8, 9 amendments, which are basically changes to conform the language to the bill that this committee had acted on, Senate Bill 1088. We have a dash 8, 10 amendment, which is a conflict amendment. This committee acted on House Bill 2085 a number of weeks ago, and if you remember, that is a bill to allow tenants associations supported by non-profit organizations to negotiate for the purchase of manufactured dwelling or floating home facilities. That was the bill that you heard, I believe, Senator E. speak to. So this is a conformity amendment. And then dash A11, which you have heard spoken to today in the definition of cable television.
Any comments on any of those? You're talking about dash 8, is that right?
Dash 89.
Dash 89. Mm-hmm. Okay. Chair, remove the dash A9s to Senate bill, or to House bill 3098. Any comments? Objections? Ordered. You just dash A10s. Chair would move dash A10s to House Bill 3098. Comments? Objections? So ordered. And dash A11. Is that what we're calling it?
Yep.
Chair would move dash A11s to House Bill 3098. Comments? Objections? So, is there a motion on the floor? The chair to move House Bill 3098 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
I make a comment, Mr. Chair. I just want to go for the record. I'm incensed by some of the comments that this bill in any way will restrict the benevolence of any owner, and I just object to that. I also object to the fact that the insinuations that folks like Ms. Fleming Barrett, Mr. Van Landingham, or Mr. Brenneman, or Mr. Miner, or the other ones, would act under duress. I know them too well. And I want to comment how much I appreciate their efforts to make this bill work for everybody. I mean, this is good for landlords. It's good for tenants. And I appreciate their efforts very much.
Further comments?
Thank you.
We've had a vote on the bill. The chair has moved House Bill 3098 as amended to the floor for due process recommendation. The clerk call roll.
Senator
Barr. Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Motion carries. Senator Nestor, you do want to carry this bill. Close work session. Any further comments?
Thank you.
Yeah.